market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that puts the new in pneumonia. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always is Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, well, I'm a little bit better now, I have to say. I am bitterly, bitterly disappointed that we missed our first ever podcast last week. We've had a very, very good track record. We haven't missed a single podcast. Unfortunately, last Wednesday I was laid a little bit low by a case of pneumonia. And unfortunately, when we should have been recording, I was in hospital getting some very, very high strength antibiotics. So unfortunately, Phil, I do apologize personally. We did try different ways of getting the podcast done. It just wasn't possible. The good news, if you like our podcast, the bad news, if you don't, is that I'm back in almost full health. We are recording this one from my place instead of the usual Triple M studios. So if it sounds a little bit different, that's exactly why. But we are back in full harness. And we've got a couple of weeks worth of podcast to get through, mate. So we won't go exactly double, but we'll try and cover a bit of news, a bit of goings-on, a bit of what's happening on the market. It's been a rough three-odd weeks since we last recorded a podcast, so we've got a little bit to cover, I think.
It's been a bit rough. It's been a bit of a red. And there's been, the return of volatility.
Exactly.
It's all your fault, Captain, because, you went away.
And then you just
roil the markets
exactly.
From far away.
Exactly. All right, so we are going to talk about volatility, as you mentioned. We're going to talk about wax stocks. I'll keep you in suspense on that one. We're going to talk about Coles. It's gone its own way now, no longer part of the Wesfarmers empire. The Royal Commission. Just is the gift that keeps on, maybe not give, maybe taking is probably right. The headline writers love it. The Royal Commissioner is looking fantastic. The banks less so. We'll also talk about, speaking of things being rejected, the reject shop. It was once a market darling, then a market, what's the opposite of darling? It was hated by most people. Maybe there's another lease of life left. And of course, because it's been a couple of weeks, we'll dig into the full mailbag.
Let's get on.
All right, mate, let's get started. Volatility. So firstly, mate, it's been a very, tough 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Happily for me, for 8 or 10 of those days, I was out of the country, out of mobile range. So it was blessed relief. I didn't have to keep an eye on it. Although I did when I had a couple of bits of mobile reception on a couple of mountains in Papua New Guinea. For those who haven't been listening to this for a while, I did trek Kokoda. Had a great time. But there's not a lot of mobile reception on the Kokoda Trail. So I did get a chance to just have a bit of a time out. But I did check the market occasionally when I did get a little bit of reception. Mate, it's been a tough 3 weeks. What is going on? What did I miss?
Well, first thing I'll say that, if you're out of reception, that's sometimes a very good thing.
It's nice.
Because that means you don't have to deal with it.
It wasn't stressful in the slightest,
And this is the funny thing about investing, right? You invest, your money has, let's say, grown, and then it falls, and it hurts. Right? And it doesn't matter whether it was, it was up 50% and is now only down 10%, but it does hurt.
Doesn't it?
So you were lucky.
That is a strange human reaction too, mate. I'm not surprised by it anymore, but I have to say, people on Twitter in particular who've been saying, oh, see, the market's crashed. I told you it was going to, or, those who enjoy a bit of schadenfreude, a bit of enjoying other people's misery. Oh, the property prices are plummeting and share prices are plummeting. And you kind of think, well, yeah, they're plummeting back to kind of February levels. Not, after growing at 20, 30, 40, 50%, it's hardly on any reasonable basis, hardly any significant fall. But as you say, it really does hurt because we kind of bank those gains and we don't like seeing them go away. Yeah,
mentally, you've banked the gains. So, it's been, I guess, the longest stretch in a while, basically means maybe a year or so.
Since the Donald Trump,
Trump election.
There was a big kind of the old taper tantrum in February.
Yeah.
Before that, it was pretty much Trump's election was the last big
volatility. And then, for Trump's election, things were, it looked like it's going down and then it went up and then, but if you look at all ordinaries then as a barometer for the market, the ASX, it's getting close to being down 10% from the highs. So, the favorite word of yours.
Don't do it.
Okay, I'll stop. Well, I'll still say it. Maybe around the corner. NASDAQ, which is the US 100 biggest non-financial companies.
Yes. Tech companies.
Yep. Well, I mean, then essentially, it's not necessarily tech because there's Pepsi in that list.
Right.
So it's 100 largest companies on NASDAQ minus tech.
Okay, fair enough. Minus financials.
Yeah, minus. What am I saying? it's all the volatility's fault. It's the red.
Fried your brain.
It's the red in the portfolio. So I'm with the listeners here.
Yeah.
So that was down at least yesterday.
Right.
About 13% or day before. That's quite a bit.
Not in a day. Since when?
Well, since like the high, which was maybe. Okay. You know, a couple of months back.
Now, mate, I find this bizarre, right? We'll try and talk about Australian stocks more than others, but I looked the other day, I think I said to you yesterday or the day before, Amazon was down 25%, Google about 20% on their 52-week highs, and that's only maybe 3 months ago.
Yeah.
It staggers my mind that companies of that size and caliber can have been re-rated so significantly downwards when nothing's changed about Google's business, nothing's changed about Amazon's business. Either the prices were way too high, or investors are panicking now, or maybe a bit of both. But that's an extraordinary. These are the biggest, or two of the three biggest companies, or two of the four biggest companies in the world, falling 20% and 25%. Yeah. That is phenomenal.
And Apple, the biggest company, that's down.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's down about 20%.
But even Berkshire was down 2.5% the other day.
Yeah, why was Berkshire down?
Which
is bizarre. So I mean, you know, you're right. In some cases, it could be that they, you know, people. Now think they were overvalued and therefore they're coming down, or that people are just, you know, running for the hills. Run.
Yeah.
And let's, you know, talking about Australian, let's get back to talking about Australian stocks.
So then, the wax. We had the fangs in the US, and the fangs are Facebook, Amazon, Netflix and Google.
Yeah.
We got wax in Australia, which I think is people trying a little bit too hard. And nevertheless, tell me what wax is and what should we
get. So wax is, you know, so fang, you know, some people go fang with the double A, some people go fang with the single A. Right. I'm happy with the single A. It's okay. It's okay with me. The wax is a wax with a double A in the middle. And the W stands for WiseTech. One of the A's stands for Altium. The other A stands for Appen.
Right.
And the X stands for zero. So these are, you know, four well-known tech companies.
Not quite Australia's answer to the FANG stocks, but about as close as we get.
This is as close as we get. These have done really well over the last few years.
Yep.
And, you know, even these have, you know, they've been paired. They've been hit hard.
Yeah, yeah.
What is interesting, I'll give an interesting example. So Appen, for example, had an earnings upgrade. It was a pretty decent upgrade. So the shares went up, but then, you know, people are forgotten about the upgrade, and, you know, it's down down to being again, you know, down, you know, significantly. So I think people, you know, when volatility hits like this, you know, a lot of people just sell.
So I have a view on this, but I'll pretend I don't for the sake of the listeners. There's two ways to look at this, right? You look at this and say the market's got freaked out, these are good quality companies that the market is kind of just, you know, ignoring because in its panic, everyone runs for the exits like a lemming. The other way is, for those of us who are a little bit, you know, been around a little while, I've got a couple of grey hairs, the dot-com crash isn't that long ago, the dot-bomb, if you like. And at that point, you know, people were saying in early 1999, or late 1999 even, these are great new business models, eyeballs, all that kind of great stuff. The NASDAQ still hasn't recovered those levels. To convince me this is the market overreacting on the downside versus the fact we may have spent the last 10 years over-exaggerating the future of these sorts of companies.
Right. So, I mean, one simple thing is that in the dot-com era, a lot of those companies, the dot-com darlings, they had just hopes and dreams.
Right.
You know, prospects of eyeballs.
All about the eyeballs.
And beautiful eyeballs, and eventually, maybe someday, potentially someone. So these companies, many of these companies did not have revenue.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. And some companies without revenue had billions and billions and billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars of valuation. Okay. Now, take Wax, for example. All of these companies actually have earnings.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's not
pretty high quality earnings still, I want to say.
High quality. I mean, Xero has just started, you know, showing operating profits. But for the rest, they, you know, they've got earnings. Some even pay dividends, you know.
They have
the capability of actually paying dividends. So this is not the same thing as the same hopes and dreams. Now, that does not say that none of, you know, you could always come back and say, oh, these are overvalued and therefore they should be, you know, cut down to size and things like that. That you could make that argument for fangs and anything else, but it is nowhere close to being the dot-com. I mean, this, you know, these are companies doing real things.
They're overvalued, but they're much, much higher quality average than those who drove the dot-com craze.
Yeah. I mean, in the dot-com days, there were days when, you know, the share price went up by hundreds of dollars in one day.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the days.
So are you buying tech stocks or are you selling tech stocks, mate? What's going on?
Well, I have been, you know, buying A little bit.
Okay.
Through and through, you know. Every time I buy, it goes down. So it's not really helping. But
so for the rest of us, if we're waiting, when do you stop buying, then we'll start buying.
That maybe that's what it is, when, you know, all he right. stops buying. Yeah, but I did buy a few things here and there. And yeah, I mean, it still hurts because, you know, if most of your money is in the market, then it hurts because it's down. But yeah, I've been buying. I think, you know, to me, it looks like it's a buying opportunity.
Yeah, I tend to agree, mate. I think there's been a lot of good stuff thrown out with the dross. I think the market's overreacting a little bit on the downside. Certainly in the US, I own both Amazon and Google, or Alphabet, I must confess. And they've been looking more and more attractive over time. The NASDAQ ETF on the ASX also looks pretty attractive. So plenty of ideas. Again, who knows what's going to happen in the short term. Long term, these are high quality businesses with high quality earnings. And even if valuation does jump around a little bit, hard to believe on average, if you take the Amazons, the Apples, the Facebooks, the Googles, add all those together, it's kind of hard to believe these businesses won't be worth more in the future,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, if you take a five-year view, you know, maybe there's more downside. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, day after, next week, but you know, we can't know that. But you know, if you think 5 years, it's very hard to believe that, you know, those businesses and many of our own tech stocks, you know, it's hard to believe that they are not going to be doing well.
And bring it back home to your point about our tech stocks. You know, we know the old line was always that if America sneezes, Australia catches the cold. And it does really seem to me that's the case. I remember back in, I want to say it was September, maybe even August, when I think both Netflix and Facebook took a bit of a tumble. The Australian tech sector really got hit hard. And it does seem like we get our confidence, our Dutch courage, if you like, from what's happening in the US. And when those markets are falling, our tech stocks really do struggle to get any context at all.
I've read things like, you know, fund managers are rotating out of tech stocks and getting into defensive stocks and things like that. Allegedly. And all those sort of things happen.
We'll see.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, let's move on from that, mate. From, I don't know about the sublime to the ridiculous, maybe it's the exciting to the boring. This week marks something of yet another turn in the Coles corporate story. So Coles once was Coles, then it was Coles Myer, then it was bought out by Wesfarmers. Now it's back on the board as ASX COL. Coles, the supermarket group, is no longer part of Wesfarmers. The shareholders of Wesfarmers now own 85% of Coles. Wesfarmers owns the other 15%.
Right.
The shares are on the market. This is something of a... if we go back to when Wesfarmers bought Coles, I don't know that they've necessarily covered themselves in glory with the purchase. The sales, it was a demerger, so it's reasonable. But it feels to me a little bit like a lost decade. Coles never really shot the lights out. They did a really good job fixing the business from how badly it was run before. But they don't seem to have been able to deliver the sort of growth or the sort of returns that maybe shelves were waiting for.
Right.
That being said, Wesfarmers no longer settled with the Coles business. They've said a lot that this is a very, very capital intensive business. Their returns on equity at Coles were far, far, far lower than the rest of the Wesfarmers group. What do you make of the businesses now separate? Do you have a view, kind of pros and cons? How are you thinking about Wesfarmers and Coles as separate companies?
So I think the point you make about, you know, the return on capital, that is going to make a difference for Wesfarmers. So if you... My view on Coles, and the same I would say for Woolies or Woolworths, is both of these businesses are fairly mature.
Yep.
I mean, they are pretty mature. So they're
totally mature, right.
Totally mature. I mean, unless we can somehow miraculously produce another 100 million people and, you know, have hundreds of new cities, I mean, where are these guys going to grow?
Right.
So they're going to grow, like, you know, they can grow at a little bit, you know, population growth type of thing.
Yeah. Plus whatever share they steal from each other, right?
Yeah, whatever, they, you know, or from others, like, you know, Aldi and things like that, right?
Sure.
So it really depends. I mean, these are good businesses, I guess, if you can buy them at the right price and then you can sort of take advantage of the dividends that they're going to pay and they're going to be potentially fully franked. So it's good for an income stream if purchased at the right price. But if you're a growth investor looking to sort of grow your money over time, you know, I just stay away from them.
Not a lot of growth in Coles, is it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, that's just I mean, and the same with Woolies. You know, they're going to steal a little bit here. They're going to, you know, reduce. It might be good actually for consumers overall.
Yeah.
Now that, you know, Coles is going to stand on its own, maybe they're going to compete even harder. That's going to maybe make prices better for consumers. Consumers are going to win.
I think that's a good point. I think I've got a grocery background way back many years ago. And I think to your point, that's the real question is how hard do these guys fight? In any duopoly, you can either kill yourselves and kill each other, which is what the airlines did for many, many years, or you can take the foot off the throttle a little bit and say, hey, if we don't go too aggressively on prices, then both of us can make a bit of money. And so it'd be interesting to see who's most desperate and when.
Yeah.
As you say, grocery can only grow at effectively population growth. At the moment, they're not even getting that because the prices have been deflating. In fact, they've been contributing to deflation or at least lack of inflation in the economy for probably 5 or 6 years, I think, as they've fought this price war, which has been great for consumers but not great for shareholders. I completely agree, Matt. I think so Wesfarmers is a buy for us at ShareAdvisor. It's also a buy at Everlasting Income. Mm-hmm. I love Wesfarmers, the business. I think what I like about Wesfarmers versus Woolworths, even back when it had Coles as part of the business, was Wesfarmers was always an investment conglomerate that happened to own a retailer. Mm. Woolworths is by definition entirely a retail business. Mm-hmm. And so Wesfarmers had the luxury of saying, let's spin off Coles, but let's keep Officeworks and let's keep Kmart, let's keep Bunnings. Mm. So it's keeping the businesses it wants to keep. It's getting rid of the ones it doesn't want anymore. Yeah. So to my mind, I think, as it turns out, Wesfarmers is a stronger business, a better quality business without Coles because of that higher return on equity than with it.
Right. So maybe there's a re-rating, as they would say. Maybe the multiple will go up.
Don't get me started on demergers. It drives me bananas. The businesses together should be exactly the same value as the businesses separately.
But then why do you merge, right? I mean, so that they must be looking for something, some sort of arbitrage.
I think the business is left over. Is a better quality business, but the two together. If you're a Wesfarmers shareholder before the demerger, the businesses you own now are the same as the businesses you own when they're one company, right? The fact that the two together trade for a higher or lower price post demerger is absolute evidence of the market's inefficiency. It's madness, but it happens, and so that's the reality. But I think just because one's a better business than the other doesn't mean they should be worth different prices. It's just a matter of how much value you attribute to each of those two businesses should be determined by the value you see rather than just some arbitrary allocation of capital.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, oh man, talk about from the sublime to the ridiculous. Let's definitely get to the ridiculous now. This one's brought to us by Rowena Orr, Council Assisting, and Kenneth Hayne, the Royal Commissioner, for this bloody Financial Services Royal Commission. It is just...
It's a never-ending process, it seems.
Again, mate, I love to call it the gift that keeps on giving, but it just keeps on taking. The line this week was from Commonwealth Bank CEO Matt Comyn, who, when he was head of retail banking of the CBA, alleges that Ian Narev, the then CEO, told him to, and I quote, temper your sense of justice. Matt Comyn wanted to stop selling a product he thought was crap, allegedly according to the evidence he's given to the Royal Commission. He was told that, apparently, we're told that his boss said to him, dude, effectively pull your head in, we can make money selling this thing, stop trying to be nice to people, how about you just make some money anyway? It's
madness.
Well, I'm trying to find the right way to describe this because this is another one, yet another, in a trail of just absolute awful behavior conduct by these banks. If this had been released in isolation, there would have been hell to pay. The reality is we're all a bit punch drunk, as I've said before in this podcast, because people are just, we're kind of over it, right? There's been so much bad news from so many different quarters, AMP, CBA, ANZ, financial planners. Pick your area.
Yep.
Everybody seems to have been doing the wrong thing to some degree or another. What are we supposed to think of a bank CEO who says, hey, stop worrying about the poor people we're selling this stuff to, just go and make some money?
So I'll say a couple of things here. One is, so I don't want to say one person is lying. It could also be that, these things are interesting, right? You have an ex-CEO.
Yep.
And therefore, as the current administration or current, managers could say, well, the ex-CEO said something, we didn't say anything.
Right? It's all his fault, right?
It's therefore somebody else's fault.
Throw the old guy under the bus.
I would say something. It is a very cultural thing because if the bank has a culture of making money at all costs, then that culture is not just at the top. It really percolates downstream. Mm. If enough number of people said, no, we shouldn't do it, I guess the previous CEO would say, well, I guess we can't do it. People don't want to do it, right? Mm. That's one. I think it's sometimes it's very convenient to essentially throw the guy who's not there under the bus, right? I mean, so I'm mindful of that. At the same time, I could totally see this happening at the bank. It's, as you said, appalling. Such things shouldn't happen, but they happen, as we have seen plenty of examples. The other news I read was that, you know, Westpac, for example, had given financial advice, and they don't even have notes as to say what sort of advice was given. Apparently, for 50% of those things, they don't even have any documentation.
Man,
so that's just madness, right? And you don't even know if the advice was actually legit.
And this, we should remember, this is a Royal Commission that many in politics and business said wasn't necessary, right? It was supposed to be all okay, nothing to see here, everyone move along.
Yeah.
In fact, I recovered before the Royal Commission. I wrote a while back that I didn't think it was worth doing because, and ironically, my point was that unless you're going to have an inquiry into the cultures of these banks, that simply examining the behavior and saying that was all wrong, now get on with it, unless you fundamentally change, and you made the point about the culture, unless you change that, nothing else changes. And I came to review before the Royal Commission, so actually I think we do need it, and here's why. But it needed to be root and branch, culture-based. You know, what are the incentives here? Why are they going about doing it this way? What has happened to the old banks of the 60s, 70s, 80s, where the local bank manager was the pillar of the community? He knew you, he knew your business, he knew your family. That sense of a bank being a... not exactly a government institution, but this kind of weird kind of quasi, literally a pillar of the community without wanting to sound too kind of rose-colored glasses about it. You know, there was that sense of kind of making, almost greasing the wheels of local business and homeowners and that kind of stuff, to the point where then it just simply became a matter of, okay, how do we close branches, save costs, all that kind of stuff. Banks are a little bit too big for their own britches, I think, a little bit too far ahead of where they should have been. And that seems to have brought them down. We await the Commissioner's report, mate. I, for one, hope it is absolutely scathing, and I hope both the government and opposition, whoever is in power when the details are released, hopefully they take a very, very, very severe look at it and do what needs to be done.
What if it just turns out to be a series of questions like it was for the interim report?
That's the fear, right? That's the fear. The fear is that I don't think the Commissioner will do it, but the fear is the government says, yep, they're all right. Let's acknowledge that. Let's accept all the recommendations and move on. You know, if there's no fundamental change here, to the culture and the way that remuneration is set, the way that expectations are set around banking, I think that's a big problem. So we wait with bated breath. We will certainly be loud and long in our criticism if they don't go far enough.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of far enough, speaking of being rejected, how's rejected. That for a segue, mate?
Almost rejected.
Almost rejected. Almost. Not quite rejected. The Reject Shop. The little $2 shop on many a street corner, many a shopping mall, down the end somewhere, down the back, where you can get your things for your kids' parties or a cheap tube of toothpaste. It was a high, it was a $15 stock at one point. And then got down to maybe $3 or $4, I want to say, when, you know...
I was going to say that, is it a $2 stock now?
No, it probably is now. These days.
So you said $2. I thought it was almost like, you know, segue that it's a $2 stock.
That's right. Yeah, $2 shop, $2 stock, exactly. $2.76 is at the moment.
Almost $2.
There you go.
And that's after...
After what?
After the opportunistic buyout, as some newspapers have quoted,
right,
has come through.
So November 9 this month, $2.02 the shares were. They're now up a good 35-odd% among friends, which is a pretty nice return in the space of 2 weeks. There's a buyout happening, isn't
it? Not nice if you think about it. 1 year ago, it was like $9 or something.
Tell me about it. So the 52-week high is $8.35.
There we go.
The 5-year high, $17.48.
Talk about retail disaster.
So is this an opportunistic buy, mate, or is this a buyer seeing a value trap and maybe losing their money?
The thing with, you know, people taking a company private is they're going to be able to maybe do things to it which is not likely to happen in the public market. Maybe they're going to take it, you know, they're going to strip costs as hard as they can, maybe take on some debt, pretty it up. Launch it back to market.
Surely not, mate. Surely not.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing has happened before.
Who would do that? Come on.
There's some examples, some Dick Smith type of examples we can talk of.
Yes. So,
I mean, that could be a story here. I mean, if, as the business currently stands, it is hard to see value there.
Yep.
Like, I mean, it is hard to see. Again, it's like, you know, it's a pretty mature business. It's
some decent competition now, right?
Like decent competition. It's fighting, struggling.
Yeah, it's fighting Kmart with cheap prices. Yeah. Big W's trying to respond to Kmart.
Yeah.
Layer on that, catch of the day,
Kogan,
Amazon. Plenty of opportunity. Yeah. The bargain hunter used to go to the $2 shop and see what they can find.
Yeah.
Now the bargain hunter can go to Kmart or Big W. They can jump online. Yeah. There's plenty of places to go and get a bargain.
Or go to the dollar store, Dollar King, or whatever it is. Right. Rich, you know? So, I mean, Yeah, it's hard to see how there's value. I mean, there might be, you know, opportunistic pricing, buy it and then, you know, pretty up the balance sheet. Or not pretty up the balance sheet, but load it up with debt.
So here's the thing, mate. So based on the last year's sales, though, it did still, $800 million worth of sales last year. It did $16 million worth of profit. It's only selling for $80 million.
Well,
now, that's kind of five times last year's sales, or profit, sorry. It's a tenth of last year's sales. On one hand, you probably don't need to do a whole lot to this business to fix it. The question is, can it be done?
I mean, it's somebody with a good operation. I mean, what you're basically saying is that it's a business that's got a fixed cost base, a largest
relatively speaking. Yep.
And therefore, if you can somehow create some efficiency, get the right products in, you might be actually able to, get that 16 million up to even like 30 million.
Right, right. Doesn't take much, does it?
It doesn't, you know, you don't need significant increase in sales to actually achieve that.
If I was a private equity, even without a whole lot of debt and everything else, if I can buy something for $80 million and get $30 million a year from it, that'd be a pretty good deal.
That's a pretty good deal.
But,
well, if you can get 30 million, the multiple would also increase on that thing,
theory,
right?
In theory.
So,
of course, that's if they can do it.
If they can do
it.
And
the current management hasn't exactly covered itself in glory, nor has the past management, by the way. The company's done about the same sales, up a little bit, call it 5 years straight, went from 711 million to 800 million. That's not exactly covering itself in glory. Profit went from 14.5 to 16.5 million over the same time frame. It's not the easiest business to be in. Here's a question for you. Would you rather be the CEO of Meijer or The Reject Shop?
Gosh, can I be of neither?
No. I'm going to hold you. Make a call.
Okay, I'll take Meijer. You know why?
Oh, okay, tell me.
Maybe I'm incorrect here, but doesn't Meijer actually own some prime property?
No, not anymore.
Not anymore?
Sold it all off in the float. DJs did. Meijer doesn't own any property. I should caveat that. I don't believe so. I think it's all leased.
Both of them look like pretty much a basket case to me. So, I don't know. I might pick Myers over
Reject Shop.
Reject Shop. Largely because it seems like, you know, they've got bigger stores. Maybe there's more opportunity of doing things. Mm-hmm. You know, here you're catering to the cheap, and there's a lot of competition in the cheap. And then people with the scale tend to win the cheap, right? Whereas in the Myers, and you're looking at more expensive, relatively speaking, more expensive things. And therefore, you know, people who are looking for some branded items, and you can maybe do things there. Those are the people who are willing to pay up for things. Maybe there's an opportunity there. So between the two, I'll call the evil, I'll pick the lesser evil. To me, it looks like Meijer. Which one would be your pick?
No, I'd go Meijer as well, mate. I think Reject Shop, well, they're both structurally challenged.
Yeah.
And frankly, they're both kind of the hostile. Neither is survival's guaranteed.
Yeah.
I think I'd rather be Meijer because I think that, to your point, there is so much cutthroat competition, the deep discount into the market.
Yeah.
I think Meijer has a decent chance of shrinking itself to, if not greatness, to something. Meijer has way too many stores. It has way too much floor space, way too many brands. But I think you can concentrate Meijer down to something. I wouldn't want to run either, quite frankly. I don't think I have the skill set for either necessarily. If I forced a bet on which one's more likely to survive and thrive, I think Meijer, don't get me wrong, I don't like either of them. I'm not buying either shares. But I think Meijer is the less likely of the two to go broke. Put it that way.
Right. Okay. So then none of them are buy recommendations.
No, sir. We won't be doing that anytime soon.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, let's move on to our mailbag. And I have to start with a bit of a cheeky interaction on Twitter that we had during the week. We had Darren Pryor, who, Darren, you've missed us before, and thank you. Darren says, I missed your weekly dose of Motley Fool Money last week. First time ever, what happened? Now, I have explained that, and I didn't. At the time, on November 19, when I responded to that, I was still in hospital. So I just said, I know, first time ever, best planning in the world, but unexpected hitch caught us blind, which in hindsight was my pneumonia. And then we had a response from View from the Bridge, who is at AWMAU, who says, I was trawling Twitter to see if I could determine the reasons for the missing podcast. Speculation loomed. Hostile taker of Motley Fool by Bruce Jackson. Malaria from PNG. Alien abduction. Looking forward to tuning on a Friday. And Darren said, all very likely scenarios. I, for one, will be listening very carefully to Scott's voice to see if it's the real thing and not some alien imposter. So, Doc, you can vouch for me or not. I think I'm the real thing.
Well, maybe you are the robot. Who knows?
It's entirely possible.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I'm a big fan of alien takeovers. So it's totally fine with me, alien takeovers.
Mate, we can pretend I was AI enhanced, but no one's silly enough to think I'm actually smarter than I was last week or the week before. So we might struggle with thinking aliens actually improved us.
Maybe the meds have done something to you.
Maybe.
Who knows, you know?
That could help.
Yeah.
That could help.
Maybe they've done something.
But, gents, thank you for your concern. I fear you probably missed the podcast more than me personally. But, again, we apologize. We desperately tried to get it working. We tried a couple of different ways. I was just too crook to make it happen. And all the beeping and pinging in the hospital wasn't conducive to recording a podcast from the hospital bed. So I'll have to ask your forbearance for us that one. And hopefully we've made it up to you this podcast. Mate, let's get back to not being about me for a second. Let's talk about other people. We had a message from Peter Kerr on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He says, hi guys, love the podcasts. Can you please cover how you value a business that may be growing very quickly, but is still losing money? Well, it doesn't have any earnings. It's going to be tough to work it out. Any thoughts? Cheers, Peter. Now, mate, you are our resident growth investor. You run Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities, as well as Motley Fool Pro. And Extreme Opportunities is all about those higher risk, higher return ideas, the ones that maybe are making a little bit of money now or not making any money yet but have big futures. Mm-hmm. This is a huge topic, and maybe we'll go into it in a little more detail in another podcast, actually. But for now, just for Peter's answer, so let's go break to it. How do you value a business
that
may be growing quickly but is still losing money?
Right. So, you know, the traditional way of doing things is, you know, you do a discounted cash flow type of model, right? That becomes really hard for early stage high growth businesses.
Well, there's nothing to discount. You can't discount the cash flows, right?
There's no cash. You know, everything is negative, right? Mm-hmm. So, it looks negative. So, here, I think you need to, I think, start. You know, I start with what I called TAM. Which is TAM. Sounds fancy. Isn't so it? I'll make it non-fancy by telling you what it is.
Good
which idea. Is essentially total addressable market.
Okay.
So first I want to understand how big the market is.
Right.
Possibly.
So it's a lame example, but for Woolies, how big is the grocery market in Australia?
Exactly. How big is the grocery market and then how many players are there and so on. That kind of decides, you know, how big of pie can you get.
Right.
Then if it is a new, then the interesting thing is that if often new companies or new growth companies operate in what I would call, they create new opportunities and new TAMs.
Okay.
Right. So if you can estimate how much that TAM is going to be, then you can see, okay, well, this company is growing revenue at a certain pace. It's still losing money.
Mm-hmm. So maybe Google, Xero moving into cloud accounting.
Right.
Yes, to some degree, it's replacing desktop accounting.
Right.
But it's also creating a market amongst people who never would have gone to a bookkeeper or an accountant, but who could see themselves using the software for themselves.
Exactly.
So it's not only entering a market that exists, but it's growing the size of that market, making it a larger total addressable market.
Exactly.
Okay.
So if you see that, then you'd see that these will be companies which will grow top line maybe 30, 40%, right? And 30%, top line growth, if you compound that, that's you're roughly looking at what, about doubling every two and a half years. That is, you know, that can play up in your mind, but if you think about that, you know, doubling every 2.5 years, in 5 years you have quadrupled your revenue. Then what you want to try to understand is, you know, does the cost of business scale linearly with growth? If it does not scale linearly with growth, which basically means that, you know, the cost at some point is going to become more or less fixed, you can then realize that if this thing can keep growing at a very high rate, then eventually there's going to be a point, you know, maybe 5 years down the lane, when a lot of the money from the top line is going to just drop straight to the bottom line.
Right. So if I'm making a building and my building margins are 20%, I can do 30% more buildings this year than last year, but margins are going to stay the same because we've got the same number of steel and concrete and workers and girders and scaffolding and God knows what.
Yeah.
But if I'm selling, say, software or I'm selling a patent or something else.
Xero is a great example. You made the software.
Right.
Software is already done.
Yep.
You're just giving the same software's access. You know, it's not even giving it. You're just giving access because it's on the cloud to new people every year. They're paying you money for using it.
So it costs me $100 to build the software in the first place.
Yeah.
In year one, I sell $50 worth and I lose money.
Exactly.
But if in year five, my $100 worth of software, I can sell $1,000 worth of it.
Yeah.
My margins expand dramatically.
Dramatically.
Right? So now, there's still some ongoing development stuff. So it's not exactly Xero, but your point is for every new customer, you're making...
The incremental cost is not that much.
Right.
So that's if you have that sort of business where there's a lot of operating, what we call operating leverage essentially possible, then, you know, then my sort of rule of thumb is I do some very simple things, try to understand these. Like I look at, you know, like what we call enterprise value divided by, say, the sales.
Okay.
Right? And I look at, you know, what sort of multiples are they selling
at? All right, I have to stop you for a second. Enterprise value is the market cap plus the debt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Market cap plus debt minus cash.
That's your net debt. You're right. Yes.
Yeah. So net debt.
And so the reason for using that is if it's one thing to say, well, you could buy my house for $1 million, pick a number, and that's what the price on the market might be worth.
Yeah.
But if I've got $500,000 mortgage, the value of the cost of buying that house is actually more because you've got to buy the house debt, plus the debt. Debt, right?
Plus the debt. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And so in that case, if you're just looking at the house value alone and not the debt, you're kind of undervaluing the business.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so the most people look at price to earnings ratios because that's, you know, companies have earnings, you look at the price, you basically say how many times of the earnings you are paying for the price.
Right.
Of course, the ratio you're paying, you know, the price to earnings depends on how fast the earnings are growth. Right, you'd pay more for a company that's growing earnings faster, you'd pay less for a company that's, you know, growing earnings slower.
Right.
You could sort of think of the enterprise value divided by sales as sort of the rough approximation for a company that's, you know, growing top line quickly, that potentially has a lot of operating leverage, doesn't have any earnings right now, you know, you can again sort of think in the same ballpark.
Okay.
Right? Again, gives you all of these things, give you a rough idea. It's not a very precise valuation. And the reason it's not precise is there's a lot of risk and uncertainty, right? You're not making money, which means if you're not making money today, I mean, you know, it might appear that, you know, I'm just using the word uncertainty for the heck of using it, but that's not really the case. Because if, for example, I have a software company that's awesome, but a very bad recession hits and I'm still not making money, I actually can go out of business.
Right.
Whereas if you are not an awesome company, but you are a steady company with a, you know, very strong balance sheet, a recession can come and you might survive. Right. So that's the uncertainty that you have to, you know, be aware of.
And frankly, you know, to just go to that uncertainty piece or the risk piece more directly.
Yeah.
If you're not making any money,
you
simply are a riskier proposition even without a recession.
Exactly.
Another competitor might come along. You may lose your source of funding.
You might not grow as fast. You know, something didn't work out. Maybe you overestimated the market opportunity. It's a range of outcomes are possible. But, typically these are sort of things we are looking at EO, trying to find high growth companies in innovative areas. If they're in an innovative area, you know, they're likely that there's not much competition. But, you know, the flip side is that they're trying to create an opportunity. Hard as well, right? Yeah. Creating a new opportunity.
Yeah, we'll do this in another podcast. It's a fascinating problem. I've worked for companies that are both innovators, and I'll include Motley Fool as one of those. I've worked for companies that are also the incumbents.
Yeah,
and it is a fascinating interaction because being the innovator, being the disruptor is bloody hard, and it's much much easier being the incumbent. Until you hit a tipping point.
Yeah.
And once you hit that tipping point, being the incumbent is just fantastically wonderful. So, again, we use Xero. Reckon and MYOB are doing a reasonable job. MYOB is doing a pretty good job of kind of keeping up with Xero and trying to fight the good fight. For a long time, Xero was the kind of upstart, the would-be, the wannabe, losing money, trying to do something differently, trying to make it work. The big guys had it all over them. They were making money. It was a good place to be. Once you kind of cross that tipping point, once all of a sudden the incumbent's on the back foot, then their margins are at risk. Their business model is at risk. They've got to try and retool. And reckon they had this problem of saying, well, geez, hang on, now we've got to try and combat cloud accounting. We're not ready for this. We don't have a business that does this.
Yeah.
We don't have the size and scale. And frankly, the corporate culture to do it, I think is fair to say.
Yeah.
MYOB is somewhere in between. And probably, I want to say, it's despite the kind of concerns about it coming out of private equity ownership, they probably benefit from being in PE ownership during that time because it probably let them or made them do some things that maybe they may not have been able to do or prepared to do as a public company.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you're facing an incumbent, chances are you're going to have to drop prices.
Yeah.
We're going to have to spend a truckload of R&D and profits are going to fall. And that's the right thing to do to fight the kind of challenger. But the markets don't want to hear about that.
Yeah.
So as a public company CEO, you've got a really, really tricky line to try and tread, right? You can't come out and say, so we're going to make less money for the next 5 years and trust me, this is the right thing for our long term. Even if it is, the market doesn't want to hear
it. Market doesn't like making less money, right? And but you're right. You know, that's exactly the strategy.
And for what it's worth, again, as the incumbent, you will have 50, 60, 70, 80 would be challengers, right?
Yeah.
Who will all try and take you down.
Yeah.
And you could go broke trying to fight all of them individually because you would be too distracted and get all your resources in all these kind of proxy fights where you end up winning the battles but maybe even losing the war. Mm. On the flip side, if you don't fight any of them, the one that gets under the guard, the one that gets through, is going to cause Mary Hill. And I think it's very, very hard being a challenger because most of them will fail. But gee, if you get it right, the incumbents are in real trouble.
Real trouble. And you can win big, right? I mean, that's sort of, what we say in EO is that, you're going to get maybe only four
extreme
or five
opportunities,
extreme opportunities.
Yep.
Maybe only four or five are actually going to work out in terms of, beating the market.
Out of
10.
Right.
Right. So, looking at 40-50%.
Yeah.
And you'd said ShareAdvisor, you're trying to get to like six or seven, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Then how do you make money? You make money because the ones that work out, they work out well. The ones that don't work out, they just bomb out.
Yeah. And I will say, so Peter, great question, mate. We'll probably do a little bit more on it. But I think that's the other thing is, this is the answer. So you say, how do you value a business? The answer is there's no easy way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a whole lot of skill and expertise and applied kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Doc certainly got that. And that's why we love him running EO for us. But specifically, I think the bigger answer is often we get it wrong. And so, our job is to try and put the odds in our favor. And as you say, Doc, deliver big winners that more than offset the larger number of losers potentially.
Yeah.
But that's the answer, right? So the methodology that you apply, and this is for every valuation methodology, for every style of investing, they will never work 100%. And so don't, on a company by company, I rant about this a lot, as Doc will tell you, with our team, and certainly maybe I've done this podcast before. One of the biggest mistakes that intermediate investors make, beginner investors make a whole lot of mistakes.
Mm.
Intermediate investors, one of the biggest mistakes they make, even professional investors, is focusing on the individual companies, not the portfolio as a whole.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared to take a portfolio approach because no method, no approach, no structure, no process works all the time.
Yeah.
And if you're scared of the losers, you're never, ever, ever going to pick enough winners to make it work.
I'll add one more thing. Another thing is chasing precision, right? I mean, if you chase precision with the only companies that you can get precision are the companies you don't need to value.
Yeah, right, right, right.
They're exactly the slowest moving companies you could value Woolworths or now Coles.
Or Transurban.
Or Transurban or Sydney Airport. But, for those, you probably even don't need to value because you could probably just look at, price to earnings or price to free cash flow, and you could get a very good handle on what the valuation is.
Because these are very stable companies.
Very stable companies.
Really understandable growth rates, all that kind of stuff.
So the modeling is useful to give you a sense of, a range of possibilities and sort of give you, it helps you understand the business better, but it does not necessarily give you a value that you can sort of anchor to and now this is the price at which I want to buy, not 10 cents more, not 20 cents more, not 10% more, but that is the value I want to buy. And that also tips a lot of people.
All right.
Modley Fool Money.
Mate, we're going to go a little bit long because we owe people an extra podcast. So I'll do one more mailbag and then
we could talk a little bit more.
We'll finish off. So got a question from DubD1 on Twitter. It's almost certainly mispronounced. At DanWhit4, DanWhit4. So I'll call you Dan or maybe you want me to call you DubD, but I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing that right. So let's go with that.
Mm-hmm.
He says, good to hear you made it back okay. So thank you. I appreciate the kind words. Keep up the good work. I love the podcast. Longer the better. So that's given us a bit of extra license to go a bit longer. He said, more segments on how different financial products work.
Mm.
It makes sense. It makes it easier for me to understand how they are slanted towards the person selling them. Now, this is a good question. So I'm going to start by asking another question back of our audience and of Dan in particular by saying, just give us a bit more information on that, if you would. Just let us know what sort of financial products you want us to talk about, how you want us to talk about them. I've got some thoughts, and I'll kick off with a couple. Doc, you may or may not want to add some, but we can do this over time. So, Dan and others, as you're listening to this, if you have some thoughts about what financial products you want us to talk about or maybe the style or structure, I think I know what you're getting at, but let us know. As always, you can email us at info@fool.com.au or hit us up on Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, jump on. It's a really great source of news. @TheMotleyFoolAU is our Twitter handle. You can get me on @TMFScottP, and you can get Doc on @AnirbanMahanti. So hit us up, let us know what you're thinking. Give us a bit more clarity on that if you can. I will start though with a couple of things, and I think that the last thing you ask is how they are slanted towards the person selling them. What I love about the question, Dan, is you've absolutely nailed the biggest problem with financial services, and that is there is so much money being made by everyone except for the customer. Mm-hmm. There's a famous old book called Where Are the Customer's Yachts? About, I don't know if it's a real story or an apocryphal story, about the author being taken out of the harbor, some marina somewhere, by a financial planner or advisor or fund manager saying, look at all my boats, look at all the, you know, I own that one, my mate owns that one. And the guy looks at him and says, well, where are the customer's yachts? And so that idea of kind of who's making all the money here is a really, really important question to ask, to understand the answer to and to be able to get right. So Dan, I'll hit you with a couple. The first is, and again, these are general, right? So I will talk about a couple of professions, a couple of roles, job roles, and just be mindful that I'm not saying everyone is terrible. I'm not saying everyone's great. I'm just saying, hey, these are some of the incentives, both conscious and subconscious, that affect all people in the financial services industry, because even those who genuinely think they're on the right thing, you can't help but be impacted by subconscious bias, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the really important thing. It's subconscious by definition, so we all think we haven't got it. That's exactly why it's so dangerous. Let me start with the first one is real estate agents. If you think about a real estate agent, you think you're employing a real estate agent, right? You think that a real estate agent's job is to represent you to get the best possible price. Mm-hmm. Now, at some level, that makes sense because the higher the price, if you're selling, the higher the commission the agent gets and the more money you get. So you get, great, that's alignment. That's fantastic. And that's kind of true, but let me kind of roll it back another way. Let's say that an agent is going to get a commission of, let me make up some numbers, $10,000 by selling my house. Mm-hmm. If he really, really, really pushes hard and gets the buyer to pay a bit more, he might get $10,500, right? So the upside there, the house is going to sell for whatever it's going to sell for. Let's pick some round numbers. Let's say it's 1%, $1 million. Let's just make those up for now, right? Mm-hmm. If the agent sells for $1 million, he's going to get 10 grand. Good luck. You get what agents never get, take that little or take more than that. But let's just say that's the number. That's great and that's fine. But where's the incentive for the agent to push to 1.1 versus try and make me accept the offer? Mm-hmm. If he accepts the offer now, he gets his 10 grand up front, the deal is done, he gets his money guaranteed, I walk away, the buyer walks away, he can move on to the next sale, everyone's happy. Mm-hmm. Why, if you're an agent, would you spend days or weeks or months trying to get an extra 5 or 50 grand out of that potential buyer for the sake of an extra $500 worth of commission? Now, would I take $500 more? Absolutely, I would. If I had to spend weeks and weeks doing it versus trying to convince the seller to actually sell for that lower price, you start to think about where those incentives lay, right? Mm-hmm. So just again, keep that in mind. Again, this is not every agent, it's probably not even most agents, but have a think about the subconscious element there. We think they want to maximize the commission per sale, and they do, but if they can make a sale now, then hey, that's bird in the hand's worth two in the bush, right? Take your 10 grand, bank it, move on to the next sale, get another 10 grand, rather than spending an extra 2 weeks trying to get $500 out of a potential buyer who may never stump up the cash. It's easier to, and more profitable to convince the seller to sell right now, and then you can move on and do something else. So that's one just to have a think about. Have you got an example for me, Doc, or a different one?
No, you go.
Or right, I'll go with my second then.
I don't want to be out of favor with real estate agents and brokers.
Here we go,
You know, I like to be in everybody's good books.
I know, mate. I'm never going to get a job anywhere else. If my little gives me the risk, I'm in all sorts of trouble. The other one is mortgage brokers. Now, again, mortgage broker, what's their job? Their job is to find me the best interest rate, right? Mm. So they should be my best friend. Except, what does the mortgage broker get paid on? They get paid their commission based on how much money I borrow. Mm-hmm. And again, think about that. So, yes, on one hand, I'm trying to get the best interest rate from a broker. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. And I think that's what the broker's trying to help me with. And again, for most of them, that's probably true. But if they can convince me to say, oh, look, you know what? That $1 million house, you know what, Scott? I reckon you can borrow $1.2 instead of $1 million. Mm-hmm. And if you could, you could buy that house over there with an extra bedroom and a bit of extra backyard. Wouldn't that be a good idea? Wouldn't you like to do that? And I sort of think, well, I go to my wife and say, honey, we can afford to borrow a little bit more. You reckon we should? Now, if that broker can get me to borrow an extra 20% more, guess what? His commission is 20% higher. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, does the broker want to give me the best rate? Absolutely. Is the broker also, though, incentivized at least subconsciously to get me to borrow more? Absolutely, the broker is. And in 1, 2, or 3 years, when they come back and say, hey, how happy are you with your mortgage? Do you want to renegotiate your loan? They're doing that, again, because they get a nice, fat, upfront commission if you take out a new loan with a new bank. Mm-hmm. And so, again, think about, are the brokers on your side? They think they are. I'm sure they believe they are. But the incentives aren't necessarily aligned with how can I minimize Scott's total interest payments, mm-hmm. and much more aligned with how can I maximize the amount of money Scott borrows, and can I begin to refinance regularly enough that I get this nice fat upfront commission every time he refinances?
Just refinance and never pay it off.
Well, this is the thing, right? So, but even if you do pay it off, that rotation is worth more to the agent than it's worth to me. So, again, and these incentives can be used in your favor. And so, again, I'm not trying to pillory entire professions here. I'm just saying, be mindful again that the brokers themselves may not be aware of it. You think you're doing the right thing. You're helping people out. It's very, very easy to convince yourself you're doing the right thing. Just be mindful of who gets paid by who, what their incentives are. So Dan, that's a couple of examples. As I said, Dan or anyone else listening, if you want to understand different products and specific products, please let us know so we can better answer those questions. But that's just a couple of examples of where, as you rightly say, some financial products, some processes are slanted towards the people who are doing the deal. Maybe we'll do insurance next week. What do you reckon, Doc?
Sure.
All right. But hit us up, Phil. Let us know what else. Now, do you want to offend any industries or professions, mate, or are you going to leave that to me?
I think you do a good job of that.
I think that's slightly offensive, but all right. That's probably it. I've made it through pneumonia-free from our podcast. We'll call that a win. Hopefully the sound was okay, fools. If it wasn't, my apologies. The gurus at Triple M, I'm sure, do a wonderful job of making this sound studio quality. Mm-hmm. If not, then we should be back in the studio next week as our plan, although it's kind of comfortable here. We might see what we can do
next week, yeah.
We may do. Yeah. We'll see what happens. Yeah. Again, as always, please do hit us up on Twitter or email. As much as we laugh about it, we do love getting your feedback. As I say, semi-regularly, this podcast is all about you, fools. We love doing it. We love chatting amongst ourselves, but frankly, we can do that without microphones. Mm-hmm. We hope to deliver on our company promise, which is to educate, amuse, and enrich. And if we've done a little bit of that this week, then we're doing our job. If we're not, then tell us what we can do better and how we can do it differently. What you want to hear about from us and how we can best help you take control of your financial futures. All right, that wraps us up. But before we go, and we haven't asked this for a couple of weeks, so do us a favor, do subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, maybe leave a review. That helps people find the podcast. And if you're enjoying it, I reckon there's a fair chance that maybe other people will as well. So that helps just bump us up the charts a little bit and gets a bit of foolish goodness into other people's inboxes as well. Speaking of which, you can get a dose of foolish insight straight to your email inbox by going to fool.com.au/triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back this week, health notwithstanding, with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.